Hello and welcome to the first Brewing Podcast of 2020. And we begin with some analysis of those high growth US businesses that have continued to be such great performers in markets, although not without some volatility. Specifically, we talked to Tom Slater of Baillie Gifford about Tesla, Shopify and Chewy. And then we round out with a bit of politics as well. And now, this is a really insightful 15 minutes or so. But first up, please listen to some very important disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Research Director here at Brewin Dolphin, and this is our first podcast for 2020, so Happy New Year to you all. And we're very privileged to have Tom Slater of Baillie Gifford. I'll do my best to remember all the important roles you have there, but I know you're a lead manager on the American Growth Fund, co-lead on the US Growth Trust.
No, that's
totally Gary Robinson.
Yep.
And then co-lead on the Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust and lots of other things as well, no doubt. So a very busy man, and we're delighted to have him here speak to us. I think in terms of content, people will know a bit about Baillie Gifford and how you manage assets. You sort of do focus on those higher growth US businesses. And we know you've done a very good job, and it's been very rewarding for clients for you to have invested in those sort of household names that we're sort of so familiar with, Amazon, Netflix, and so forth. But we want to spend some time talking about perhaps some of the new additions in the portfolio of names you're less familiar with, or our listeners will be less familiar with. But we can't avoid, I'm afraid, Tesla, a stock you're always bound to talk about. But at the moment, of course, it's riding high, and the shorts are feeling the pinch. First of all, perhaps remind us of your, you know, broad investment case, but then maybe some explanation as to why it is capturing markets' attention at the moment.
Yeah, sure. I think electric vehicles are better than internal combustion engine vehicles. You know, they're faster, they're safer, they can adopt new technologies like autonomy faster. And if you can sell them at the same price point as internal combustion engine cars, then the evidence is that consumers are very willing to adopt them. And so, you know, with the Model 3, the equivalent of the BMW 3 Series, Tesla has achieved that price comparability in the US, and that's driven significant adoption. It's just opened its manufacturing facility in China. It's been able to drive a lot of efficiency in that manufacturing process. It can achieve that similar comparability in China now, and that's the world's biggest auto market.
I mean, interestingly on that, obviously the US-China trade wars taking a bit of a reprieve recently, but Tesla's very, well, is a unique business, and it's been able to access the sort of Chinese consumer without a joint venture. I mean, do you have any concerns about its intellectual property and associated potential sort of transfers, unsolicited transfers?
I think China is the world's biggest auto market. If you're going to be a global car company, you've got to be able to compete there, and the tariffs etc. make it very difficult to do that from an import perspective. So I think they had to be there. They took advantage of the new rules that allowed wholly owned subsidiaries. I think the other piece of it is that I think the Chinese want electric vehicles.
Yeah.
You know, penetration of EVs in China is higher than just about anywhere else.
Standard of living is a big focus for them, isn't it? You
know, air quality, absolutely. And so, you know, is there a risk from espionage and technology being stolen? Yes, I think absolutely. But the bigger opportunity is to build the brand in China and to win the Chinese consumer on the basis of quality and the standard of the product. And I think one of the big changes that electric vehicles bring is that it really becomes a software business. I think one of the massively underappreciated aspects of Tesla vehicles is that they get better as you own them, not worse. Yeah. As the software is updated. And now if you know, you go back to other software businesses, I think this, you know, sure there are some advantages in hardware, but if it's the user experience in the software that becomes much more difficult to simply copy.
And I sort of derailed you a bit from the broad bull case. I mean, the software to a degree, I mean, you have sort of see three key drivers, don't you? For Tesla.
I think there's the internationalization of the manufacturing footprint. You know, it's in the abstract, it's bonkers to be manufacturing all your cars in Silicon Valley and sending them off around the world. So as you build out that manufacturing footprint, you reduce cost, and I think you can probably increase quality. I think the other important one is the launch of the small SUV, the Model Y, which is coming this year. That's important because it's a huge segment. There's a price premium versus sedans, and actually the cost of manufacture is broadly similar. So that would be a huge driver of profitability as we look out over the next year or two.
Okay, the sort of standard or the bare sort of standard argument is that this balance sheet is too vulnerable. Do you observe any improvements in that regard, or to what extent do you see that as a sort of tangible threat?
Tesla's issues have been self-inflicted. It's been trying to ramp the production of the Model 3, their mass market vehicle, and that's taken longer than expected, and therefore it's been a drag on cash flow. And so what they thought they had enough cash, but it turns out that they haven't had. But now you're at the position where they will be have manufactured around 400,000 vehicles last year. You're in a much more sustainable point of view from the cash flow generation in the business. They did a capital raise last year, which has put the balance sheet in a much stronger position. And then what we've just talked about, the new product introductions and the lower manufacturing costs, you know, I think we should be talking about this as a profitable cash flow generating business in the foreseeable future.
Okay, well, thank you for that explanation, and well done to you for holding on. I mean, it just seems as though everyone outside of Bailey Gifford, or certainly a lot of people, just sort of hated it. Do you ever sort of feel any pressure internally from that swathe of accusation that these guys don't know what they're doing?
I mean, I think the core for us is look for businesses that have a chance to have a big enough opportunity that they could be one of the small number of outliers in stock markets. And where we find that, be long-term and patient holders. And you know, if you look at the big winners of the past couple of decades, they've all had periods where they've been extremely out of favor. You know, Amazon is our biggest winner. That fell by a third from 2004 to 2006, halved in 2008-09. There's been times when it's made us look very stupid. And that same goes for all of our most successful holdings. And I think that's part of the reason why lots of people say they're long-term investors, but they, in the end, they're not, because they go through periods like this, like the one we've been through with Tesla, and the pressures get so large that you can't hang on to it. So actually, the key to being a long-term investor is resilience in the face of skepticism. So, no, we haven't found it that difficult.
Right, okay. Well, thanks again for the comment on Tesla. Let's flip to some names that perhaps our listeners are less familiar with. Certainly I am. Apologies to our listeners do know these businesses. But Shopify, for one, perhaps an explanation behind its business and actually why it's doing so well. I mean, it's been a fantastic share for you. And I also note that you added in the third quarter under some quite sort of intense weakness for the share, which has also sort of come back very strongly. So I don't know to what extent you may also want to talk a bit about timing, but let's start on with the business and why it's been such a successful share for you.
Yeah, so it probably stems from thinking about how can merchants operate in this world of giant platforms. It's clear that competing directly with Amazon is not going to work. And what Shopify have done is actually thought about how you empower smaller merchants to operate in this world. And so building the tools that they need to efficiently build a website, to take payments, to get returns, to buy shipping, increasingly to do logistics. And by providing those services for their customers, they've allowed those customers then to focus on product differentiation, brand building, social media presence, the things that retailers should be focusing on, merchandising, but still be able to compete in terms of costs.
So it's allowed retailers to sort of focus on their own areas of expertise, isn't it? And so to what extent does Shopify sort of work with Amazon, or does Shopify somehow take any revenue away from Amazon?
I think you would characterize it without sort of rather ugly term, frenemies.
Right.
That Amazon set out trying to do something like this, some of these tools for third-party retailers, but effectively gave up and then started recommending that third-party retailers use Shopify. And so Shopify is powering a number of the third-party retailers that are transacting on their site. On the other hand, you know, it's absolutely in Amazon's interest for small retailers to be absolutely dependent on them, so they can be commoditized and Amazon can take the margin. So, I think they serve quite different purposes, basically. Amazon is very much focused on consumers. Shopify is very much focused on merchants.
So you say they're a very helpful platform for small and medium-sized businesses. Are these businesses so small that we may never have heard of them, or are there some examples that have really leveraged Shopify to great success that we may have heard of?
So they started out in being a tool for small merchants, but they've increasingly moved into larger and larger businesses. But you can think of some of these direct-to-consumer brands. You know, Kylie Jenner Cosmetics would be a great example of that. That's become a huge business with a skeleton employee base, basically using the tools of Shopify to monetize her social media presence. But it's very likely that you have shopped from a Shopify merchant in the past year.
Right, okay, fine. Okay, and then let's move on to some entirely new purchases. Chewy is obviously a standout name that would merit further explanation. I doubt it has much to do with the Star Wars franchise.
They sell animal food and pet care products. And that is interesting for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's a category that obviously should be online. These products are bulky, you buy them regularly, you know, you don't want to be going to the supermarket, you want to have them delivered to your home. Secondly, it's a category which is quite hard for Amazon to compete in.
So what's the European business? Is it Zalando or something that does?
It's not Zalando, but there is a European equivalent.
Yeah, okay.
Whose name temporarily escapes me.
We'll edit that bit out, don't worry.
But the premise is that Amazon does not have a pricing advantage because pricing is controlled by the brands. There's a regulatory problem. They don't have a selection advantage because a lot of these brands are really interested in being able to tell their brand story, to explain to the pet owner why they should use this brand. And they're therefore reluctant to work with Amazon, but they're happy to work with a specialist like Chewy. And thirdly, this is a really high touch purchase. There's a huge amount of interaction with customer service, and is this pet suitable? Is this product suitable for my pet? How will it interact with some of these other things? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's something like 80% of purchases have some touch point with the customer service operation. And of course, Amazon is very much about very low touch customer service. And so you're seeing very rapid adoption. Your growth rate's around 40% plus. But it's still relatively low penetration. It's about 11 million customers on Chewy. There are about 85 million pet-owning households in the US. So I think there's a lot more to go for here.
Now, a very unfair question to finish, because we know you spend the vast, vast majority of your time trying to find businesses that can grow at a very smart clip with a large, addressable audience. And what a great job you've done at that. But as investors, you know, in the short term, we get buffeted around by, you know, macro news and political news. And clearly there's a US election coming up this year, and there are some contenders that may be deemed less favourable to big tech businesses deemed to be sort of monopolistic operations. And I'm thinking about sort of the progressive left candidates here. I mean, would you think an outcome that delivered one of those more progressive candidates as being a medium to sort of long-term genuine threat to the sort of strategies that you employ, or just something more sort of short-term? And not that that is our base case in terms of the electoral outcomes, but, you know, it is, of course, a potential.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the short run, probably markets will prefer the status quo. But I think there are some big structural problems in America that need to be addressed. You know, you've almost got a two-speed system where, in, you know, red, as illustrated by the fact that red state life expectancy has been declining for 5 years. I mean, it's astonishing. It's not something we've seen since the Depression. And it speaks to the huge inequality in U.S. society. And I believe that if you see measures to address that, then it's probably better for the health of the U.S. consumer over the medium term. And so, yeah, I think potentially short-term headwinds, but I think it's probably a good thing for some of these businesses over the long run.
And I did threaten it was the final question, but this is genuinely the final question. I mean, how are you seeing your sort of broad opportunity set, asset class? I know you're long-term investors, but does this feel like one of the more expensive times to be buying growth, or actually is it looking, you know, pretty reasonable?
Well, the barometer I have for that is what does the flow of our new ideas look like? You know, it's a low turnover strategy. We own companies for a long period of time, but you want to be coming up with ideas to test and have that tension, that competition for capital. You know, I don't own Amazon because we've owned it for years and I don't want to sell it. We own it because you're looking at a new idea every week or two, and you can't make the case for the risk adjusted upside being more attractive than what we see at Amazon. And you know, I think there are some really interesting ideas out there. I think, you know, because you're still quite early in the period of change in media and in retail, that throws up interesting opportunities. You know, we added to Wayfair, the online furniture retailer, recently. Big category, still in the nascent stages of development. But there are plenty of interesting companies, either listed or private companies, that are coming to market. That create that tension for competition for capital. So I'd really be quite optimistic about the outlook.
Okay, great. Well, Tom, thanks very much as ever for your contribution, and we wish you ongoing success with your range of strategies that I so incorrectly associated with you at the top of the meeting. But of course, you're our lead manager on the American Growth Fund, which we continue to support at Brewin Dolphin. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening, and welcome any feedback on Twitter or SoundCloud, whatever platform you listen to us through. But until next time, many thanks for joining us.